Hello, everybody. Welcome back. That's a fancy graphics effect. May we take a minute to try to sort that out? I've got a list here with the lightning talks, and we have one slot free. So if you're now thinking it would be actually great to have 10 minutes time to talk about my project or another topic that is of interest to you, come to me, sign up. The last slot is still free. Otherwise, we have the first slot already on stage, and then we will directly go over to the next one and continue until coffee break. I hope you had great sessions in the last slot, and everybody was finding back their way to this venue. At least here we had a fruitful discussion about the future of LGM, some ideas, and which we'll announce on Saturday, so stay tuned. And that looks good.
Okay.
Perfect, then, thank you.
Right. Cool. My name is Jussi Pakkanen, and I'm here to talk about CAPI PDF. And you might be asking, so what does it actually do? Well, as you can tell, it's a capybara, which has nothing to do with PDFs, but that's the thing anyway. So the idea is that it's a library that you can generate PDF files. Now, there's lots of those available, and they all do kind of like slightly different things. There's like Cairo and all sorts of things. And the point of CAPI PDF is that it provides a programmatic API to the PDF primitives themselves. It doesn't have any sort of its own document model or anything. It just exposes what you have in the PDF, and it does nothing else. So if anyone files an issue, it's like, could you add this functionality in? It's like, is it in the PDF spec? No, not adding it. They're very, very strict about that. So it is fully color managed, does all of the RGB, gray, CMYK, spot colors as well. There is actually a production in print as we speak that uses spot colors from this. It hasn't come out yet from the printing press, so I don't know if it actually worked, but it's in testing, as they say. So the idea is that you want to provide all of the possible PDF versions that there are, PDF-A, PDF-X, PDF-UA. Some of them work, some of them don't work yet, but the plan is to add all of them. And to support all of things, you have gradients, you have forms, you have annotations, and so on. Like in PDF, you can specify your gradients in lab space, which is kind of cool, and all that sort of thing. And the idea is that all of the functionality that is in PDF will be supported eventually. Technically, the more important is that it provides a plain C API. And this is so that it's as easy as possible to use from any system that you have. You have like Python, Perl, or Ruby, Java, whatever. They all talk plain C. So then this is the way to get maximal ease of integration. So you don't have to deal with Swig or any of those things. It is not implemented in C. This is like a very big decision. There's enough C code in the world already, so let's not add to that. But also, it's designed to be minimal. So there are only 6 external dependencies, which are like libpng and those sorts of things. So like the goal is to keep the dependency list as low as possible. Now, in the world of today, where like you need 500 dependencies to determine if a number is equal or not to some other number, this might seem like a weird thing to do, but this is the way we have chosen to do it. And also, there's a Python binding that ships with it. And it's actually on PyPI, so if you want to use it, you can just pip install it right now. There are no wheels on Linux because of the obvious reasons, but it works for Mac and also for Windows. And you can build it yourself. It's quite easy to do that. So then Baro is like, OK, so how mature is it? And the big thing is that in Inkscape 1.5, there's going to be the new CMYK exporter, which is which we heard about yesterday. And that is built on CAPI PDF. So this is a collaboration between Martin Owens and the people on Inkscape side who are doing the parts on Inkscape, and then me doing the PDF generation library. So it's kind of like a split of work. And this presentation has been created with a Python script using CAPI PDF itself. Now, this would have transitions both between slides, also within slides. The problem is that there's only one application in the entire world that shows within page transition. That's Acrobat Reader, and I don't want to use it because of Adobe, so you can't actually see them. But if you want to try it at home, you can do that. And also, you can tell that this is not made with LibreOffice because the text is evenly split between the two lines. It's not one long line and then a few words afterwards. Because when you write your own presentation software, then you can also do, you have to do your own line splitting, and then you can do it right. So the obvious follow-up question is that, does this mean that anyone can now export print quality PDFs? So things like GIMP or Krita or so on. And the answer to that is maybe. The idea is that we want to provide the library so that they can do that. But then, of course, I can't speak for the other projects on their behalf, whether they actually want to use that. But like, in theory, this could be used to create PDF print quality PDF export directly from any application that wants to use it. So to close things down, let's create a PDF X3 document, which is a very specific kind of way you have to create your things so that when you send out to get printed, it actually works and the outcome is correct. Now, this seems like a lot of work and difficult, but this is actually all you need to do. And this is a unit test from inside of Carry PDF. So basically, you just need to specify all the things that are there, like the color space and the color profiles and so on. And then you have some text, then you have some graphics, and then you say, render this out, and that's it. And this is the end of the talk. Right.
Thank you. Thank you, even louder. Here we go. Thank you. Any question while we switch over? One question over there. And let me do some running.
So one of the annoyances I found with PDF is that PDF 1.0 didn't have alpha compositing, which was introduced in PDF 1.2. So the way that it actually is in the PDF itself is that you repeat the geometry for the alpha versus the color. So if you're going to have a shape with some gradient and it's also going to have alpha, you actually have to do it twice. Does Cappy PDF abstract over that?
So Carry PDF abstracts away absolutely nothing. What you get is like you need to figure out how your thing would need to be expressed in PDF primitives. Like transitioning from your internal document model to the PDF document model is the application's problem, and then the PDF command stream getting that to a PDF that actually works properly, this is our problem. So the question was, what's Carry PDF written? It's C++. And it takes, I tested it on this laptop using one core it builds in 40 seconds. It's about 15,000 lines of code. Oh, do you still have a question?
Yeah. Do you know about the opposite of Cappy PDF, like what would you recommend to pass a PDF into its primitives?
From what I can tell, Inkscape does it pretty well, but I haven't had this problem. So generating PDF is a lot easier than parsing it because it's so massively complicated. And if you read it, you have to like do all of it. But if you generate it, it's like, yeah, well, we can just leave out all of the old thing no one uses. So.
Okay.
Maybe the next speaker would want to come up.
Yeah, exactly. Let's move on with the second slide. If no other question arrives, or is there any question for the first one? Not the case. Okay, then we'll just switch over. Thanks again for your lightning talk. And I will shameless use the time to present these lovely bags again. And the even lovelier t-shirts. which we have plenty of, and it would be a shame if Lasse would have to wear like all this t-shirt on its own during the next year, so for the rest of his life, exactly. So if you want to take something home with you, maybe a t-shirt is a good thing, and if you have no space, it doesn't matter, just take a bag next to it so you can carry it. You ready?
Yeah. Hello, can you hear me? Am I on? On the internet, I go by the artist name of Janone, but please call me Jan. My claim to fame is this typeface here, Janone Kaffeesatz, even though I wish I was known for other things. I'm a type designer, and I stand firmly like with one foot in like open source development and the other with the other foot in commercial type design and commercial projects. One of my projects, that a font that I'm going to publish, is very big, Arabic, Cyrillic, Greek, and Latin, has lots of features and variable axes, and so I thought it's almost impossible to generate meaningful sets of web fonts for that gigantic variable font, which is 1.5 megabytes in size. And I looked at the available online subsetters that are, there's a brief overview, don't look at the details, but the benchmark is basically, I think the best known one is Font Squirrel, the web font generator at Font Squirrel. It's lacking so many features that I would like to have, such as subspacing, reducing the design space of variable fonts. You can choose from 34 predefined languages, but there are only languages, like you can't choose writing scripts, Cyrillic, Arabic, whatever. So it's extremely limited, has an extremely limited feature set. And so I started with the, so I contracted for Google Fonts as a font engineer for the last 6 years. They paid for part of the development. This is completely alpha. I don't actually consider myself part of the LGM community, but it's already my second time here. So maybe at some point I have to stop deceiving myself. And I just forgot what I was going to say. Set out to develop a wrapper, basically just a convenience wrapper around existing tools. There's an overview here. I started with a pure Python implementation, wrapper around PyFT subset, so the subsetter of font tools, subsetting as in reducing the glyph amount. Then PyFT feed freeze, you can freeze features, open type features. Also in use is remap layout, taken out of the Google Font tools. I copied that to not have to create the dependency. Of course, web font compression algorithms. And so at the very basic, you can, this is totally alpha, yeah? There's like no finished product. This works, you can install this from PyPy. You just hand over a bunch of Unicodes. You can subset, subspace, we call it, variable axes, freeze features, remove features, compress web fonts, and that's it. And so this is, of course, not happening on the web. The main value of this is a web-based in-browser, entirely in-browser-based tool. Only a part of which works. Like, I got stuck with a lot of UI programming because I'm not a, you know, not a UI programmer, and so I can drag a font here, select it. This is a source. Then I can create a target from that, and there's a symbol here that notifies that it should be generated. So this whole thing runs, uses that Python tool I showed just now with PyoDide, and then calls all kinds of tools that do the actual work, font tools, most notably the Zopfli compression algorithm via PyoDide also into the browser. The idea is that later, I modularize this into a pure JavaScript interface. At the moment, everything is a bit all over the place, but I want to modularize this into a pure JavaScript interface so that later, because this is not the fastest implementation using Python in the browser, but There are already replacements for these tools that I'm using here implemented in pure JavaScript or even in Rust via WebAssembly. And so then later on, the Python components can be swapped out in place, what is it called, in whatever, to other components, and people don't have to change their implementation. So I will, at the end, I will provide a website that looks a bit like this, upsetter dot whatever, I don't know yet. But the idea is that other people can implement or just like call one JavaScript file and then use their own interfaces and most notably use their own language selection. So now at the moment you can actually only choose between uncompressed. Here it shows you after generating the file reduction. But then there's ShaperGlot. ShaperGlot is Simon Kozin's implementation of calculating language support of fonts based on the Google Fonts Languages database. And I will implement this as part of, I just drag the font there, and then it shows, you know, these Cyrillic languages are supported and so on. This is ShaperGlot, but I will implement the same ShaperGlot as part of Upsetter. And then as part of all the stuff that you can choose from to shrink your font, part of it will be a language selection interface so that you can really only shrink, this is where it becomes important for my font, where you can really only shrink it to support English and Arabic or Turkish and Persian and so on and so forth. It's completely impossible to provide a meaningful prefabricated set of web fonts to customers. And so there needs to be a very easy to use interface that end users of fonts can use that still have all the professional features, and such a tool doesn't currently exist. Yeah, here you can choose the OpenType features. I will make some kind of interfaces, for example, to choose figure sets, table figures, lining figures, and so on and so forth. Currently, these are hidden under LNUM and ONUM and PNUM and so on and so forth. I will make it into a interface that will kind of resemble the user interfaces of typography applications to make the selection process of the OpenType features as easy as possible. These are only the user-exposed features, those OpenType features that users are meant to choose from. Other features that are automatic, such as required ligatures and stuff, are not even available here in this interface because this is a professional tool, and the core set of features, you're not supposed to mess with them, and so I won't even expose them here. Yeah. That's kind of it. And then, so this part here with the download, this is already fully functional. I can choose to make a compressed web font generated and then see that it's sitting currently at 32% of the original file size and then download it. So far, it's functional. There was a, at the beginning of my talk, there was a GitHub address here. That's the current state of development. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions for Jan? While we get the second speaker on stage.
So Jan, what's the license?
The license?
Apache 2.0.
Thanks.
As is required by everything that Google pays for. And so this was a natural choice.
OK, that was the second question.
Well, not really a question, but you said you don't feel like a part of LGM, but Kritalogo uses your font, so not sure if you're aware. What? I'm sorry? Krita uses Kafizats as the font for the logo, so you're kind of integrated already.
It's not a choice.
Okay, any additional questions?
Any other question? If not, oh, there's one. Lasse, could you jump? Thanks. Last question, and Jani will have to.
Yeah, thank you for your presentation. I heard recently there is this new spec coming up that you can patch during the loading time, like existing font with like additions. Is there a plan that your tool is supporting that?
No, there is no plan to integrate that. I don't know how that works. It's called incremental font transfer. I have no understanding at this point how incremental font transfer works, but in my understanding, there should be some kind of server-side component that supports that. And so I see this mostly as a server, yeah, as a server-side implementation. My tool is to generate static or variable, like standard web fonts. Yeah, of course, like incremental font transfer will supersede this technology eventually.
Okay, thanks. Then, stage is yours. Yeah,
thanks, so. Yeah, hello everyone. Well, first, thanks for having me. Like, it's always great. It's my second LGM. And I always really enjoy like seeing all the talks, talking to us all many very interesting people that you all are, and I know that it's gonna continue the whole week. So I really enjoy being here. I hope you do too. So I wanted to present my hobby project that I've been working on for like basically 5 years now. So starting to get somewhere. Cool Lab. So it's node-based generative art software. Basically looks like this, but I think I'm gonna go to a live demo. Yep. Yeah. All right. So yeah, node-based. The goal is to be like very easy, very intuitive. So that's really what I focus on. So you just start with whatever effect, and so for example, I can use webcams, which is always fun. So yay. Okay. So got webcam. You can like get whatever import videos or start with basic shapes, whatever. And then you just apply effects on top of it. And yeah, I think it's big enough. Maybe I can scale UI, because that's something I implemented recently. So let's flex a bit. But yeah, whatever. Let's apply some effects. For example, kaleidoscope is very fun. So yeah, already got something interesting. And then you just like effects on top of effects. So for example, I can colorize my thing. And let's animate this thing. So I got a parameter called time. So let's try putting time into there and just press play. And yeah, you got something that just works. But we can use time like wherever. Maybe angle is fun also. A bit fast, but let me slow it down. Yeah, so and then yeah, you can do like whatever and just there's a ton of effects and you can play around with it. So yeah, so that's basically it. Like just play around with all the things. And there are other tools in this kind of domain, the main one being Touch Designer, which is a proprietary software. There's also Tool 3, which is called Tixel now. My big difference with them is that I really try to be as simple as possible, as high level as possible. In Tool, you have to know a bit about buffers and render targets and shaders. And you have to be a bit of a programmer. And I try to really stray away from that and just say, nah, everything is hidden. You just do things and it works, and you get implicit conversions all over the place, and it just works. And yeah. Yeah, basically it. Yeah, here are a few things that I've done and that other people have done with it. It's mostly a 2D thing, mostly, so because I don't know, that's what I like to do. So just lots of 2D patterns, noise, etc. It started as a 3D thing, so you also have some 3D shapes, and you can do cube. And I don't know how many of you have done like Shadow Toy, ray marching stuff, SDF. So it started with that, and then I built a tool around the thing that I learned because I was bored of just coding it all the time. So, but yeah, you might recognize some effects, but like maybe so, yeah, you can like repeat things infinitely because like it's not meshes, it's another representation, which is very cool. I'll have to do meshes at some point because it's also pretty useful. But yeah, and maybe I can twist it. And maybe that's a bit too much. Let me fix that. And again, you can animate it very easily. It's also designed to do like live audio visuals, VJ performance, like React to Audio. You can do a lot of stuff, control it with MIDI, and etc. Let me just do some time animation for this one, because time on a sine wave to make it oscillate. And it goes way too far, so maybe minus 0.1 to 0.1. Yeah, and slower. And yay, you got stuff. So yeah, that's basically it. Yep, and if you're interested, yeah, come talk to me, check it out. We released 1.2 recently, so yeah, thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Again, questions? Are there any questions? Everybody's already playing, and no way. Oh, there's one. I will run over to you.
Is there a way to sync the visuals with music through, I don't know, MIDI maybe?
Yay. I got two things. I got MIDI signals that you can receive, but I'm not really doing like notes, MIDI notes. It's more like triggers and values and numbers. You can do audio. You can. Oh, unfortunately, my mic is broken, but you can get either. Audio. You get volume, waveform, spectrum. So, yeah, and I don't have a mic, but yeah, you can import a file or yeah, just whatever device you have on your computer and. I might find a file somewhere. But yeah, you can do basic audio. It's not very advanced. Like, I know that Touch Designer has lots of stuff, like kick detection, BPM detection. Like, it will come someday. But yeah, I got the basics of it, just spectrum and waveform, yeah, and volume, which is already, you can already do fun stuff with just volumes and things bounce in rhythm with a volume. And it's already quite cool.
OK, another question over here.
Okay, two quick ones. What is the language that this is programmed in? And the second one is, each of these modules, if I want to customize and create my own module and add to it, is it extensible or what interface do you have?
Yeah, very good question, thank you. So the language is C++ and OpenGL. I'm porting it to WebGPU, but in progress. And for the nodes, it's all some GLSL text files, so it's actually very easy. It's one of the core design things. Also, it's very easy for users, but also for developers. So you just use a data folder, and I think I might have some custom ones in nodes. Yeah, no, I don't. But you just write, I can show you. You just write a small text file, basically pure regular GLSL, and that's done in just hot reloads, and you're done. I can show you. Nodes, whatever, like, let's say a very simple one. Yeah, just color. Yeah, it just takes a color, you and returns it, and it just looks like it's literally GLSL with special syntax to know which variables will show up in the UI. Some special types, because we support different color spaces, so you just say, oh, I'm using OKHSL or OKLab, and you receive or output a color in that space, so it just works. So, yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
Yep, maybe a short.
Any other question?
Small example, like, yeah.
Otherwise, we'll switch over to the next speaker and announcing last time we have still one slot free. So for the very spontaneous people. And thank you.
Thank you.
I'm very curious if this editor we have just seen can produce art like these. Nice logo.
No. I have display ports, but not HDMI.
Oh, I see.
Display port or USB?
If I can't project, I can't project.
Oh, no, it's display port.
Okay, display port. Luckily, we have experienced people here having a bunch of different adapters.
Darfst du das mitgeben?
Yeah.
I just learned there's a donate button on the website. Indeed. Indeed. Yeah, and something magically happens once you press this, I was told. So the excitement and the happiness of the main organizer raises with every press of this button. If you type in an amount. And I mean, this is something actually which we tackled in our session just before, like how to make it more sustainable, but do it on a regular basis. So maybe it's too much to spend, I don't know, $100, but maybe like two every month.
Okay. I only need it in one place, so. Oh, am I awake? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me at the back? I commiserate. Okay. My name is Liam Quinn. I'm here with the GNU Image Manipulation Project, the GIMP. A year ago, I got up. Some of you may remember I gave a talk, a long, boring talk about OpenType features last year. And we had a really exciting workshop with lots of energy about the idea of making some kind of cross-application, cross-desktop portal so that a user could choose fonts even if they'd installed applications in Flatpaks or in containers. Instead of having to install the fonts in the containers, you would install desktop-wide fonts. And choosing and configuring fonts is really hard, right? Choosing, because OpenType gives you this long, bizarre list of feature names that only seven people in the world, two of whom are sitting right here, understand. DFLQ5 or something. They're all four-letter names. And four-letter words aren't always rude, but when you try and get, so the idea is how can you make this accessible to humans who are not programmers, which is most humans, like it or not. So we started a project. At the workshop, we talked about starting a project at Free Desktop, which seemed like a really good place. It turned out not to be a really good place because months later nothing had happened. I mean, I created the project, but months later nothing had happened. It hadn't appeared on their website. It hadn't been accepted. And I didn't push too hard because at the same time we had a Summer of Code student who's great. If you're listening, hi, Idris. Thank you for your work. And we had a whole bunch of infrastructure problems that we had to deal with in GIMP before we could even begin this work. So we've done some of them. And one example is that we relied quite heavily on FreeType and Pango. Pango's a library that does a number of things, but was originally written for internationalization support. It does fonts and fallbacks. But it's got some seriously broken aspects. And we had a conversation with the maintainer of Pango. And he said, well, I'm not really going to fix that. I've got a Pango 2 branch, but it's dead. So we had planned to use the Pango 2 branch, but it's dead. And instead, he says, Pango's going away. We'll use it. So what can we do? So what Idris did for us is he built a library, our GIMP font factory, that can load fonts. We had a problem. Inkscape had this problem too, and may still have it, which is years and years ago, Microsoft put out a spec for font names. And anyone who's not used to reading specs didn't notice the footnote on the last page that said all existing fonts must continue to be supported. But what it said is every font must have one of these, a name in this format, like this is IMFEL, so you can have IMFEL regular, bold. There's a list of acceptable names, and they correspond to weights and widths and slants. But font designers are creative people, and they're quite happy to make a font foundry whose name is Underwear, or and to have a font called Sauna Steamy, where Steamy is the font style. And that's not bold, that's not italic. And they might also have Sauna Humid. I'm making that one up. I don't remember what the font styles are for the Sauna font family. But and the problem with that was, both in Inkscape and in GIMP, that would just show up as Sauna because Pango would say, that isn't a recognized font style. I'll drop it on the floor. That's useful. don't know what to do with stuff, delete it. We had a goal that creative people should be able to use creative fonts, including Libre, OFL fonts, any font that you've got on your system you ought to be able to use in GIMP to do graphic creative work. But if you've got a list of six fonts that all have identical names, and when you choose one, you can't predict which one it is, and when you load the font next time, again, it might be an unpredictable one, that's no good. So a lot of work went into replacing that Pango functionality, creating a font config files on the fly, in fact, renaming the fonts. And so there's a whole bunch of infrastructure that's happened. There's other work that's been done too. With the latest release of GIMP a week ago, I find that with 13,000 fonts active on my system, GIMP starts up in about 10 seconds, 6 to 10 seconds. It was taking 2 minutes. Okay, so that's where we are. Yeah, it's not supposed to do that when I'm projecting externally. It's stupid. Oh, yeah, sorry. So we've done I didn't quite finish these slides, but these are done in GIMP. So the infrastructure is there for OpenType features. We've got the CT there, for example, is a historical ligature. That's the HLIG feature. And you can't really tell the OJ there is kerned. That's the kern feature. The tool S there, I mean, you can basically, you've got font feature. Internally, we have some font feature support. We can't even begin to think about a portal to users' fonts and a UI until we've done quite a lot more work. So I hope that next year, I'll get up here and say, we're kind of following in Krita's footsteps in a way and going in a different direction in another way. But I felt I owed you a status report that says we're on our way. And what we'd like is to have something that's cross-application so that we can share code between all the graphic design projects. And in fact, the GIMP Font Factory library has been written with that in mind as much as possible. Some of it will have to change to be plugged out of GIMP, but not much.
It is turned on.
Says 0102 on her. Oh, yeah, you can hear me. I just had to turn it round, or you had to do something more lightly. All right. I haven't got future work on here. Future work is continuing what we're doing. Currently, we have a second Google Summer of Code student. Idris is still working with us, which is fabulous. We have another one who's coming in to rationalize the font menu. And the six people in the world who understand OpenType font feature names vastly outnumber the number of people who understand how font names work in fonts and the font name table. So that's going to be exciting. And yeah, Felipe is nodding his head. He knows how complicated this is. And I'm hoping also to do things like have a little button on the font chooser that lets you search the Google Font API, for example, which is because that's one of the largest easily accessible collections of open font license free fonts that has actually had any curation done to it. Unlike, for example, Open Font Library, where you're kind of on your own for quality and glyph coverage and metadata. Okay, so all I wanted to say, thank you. It's more than I wanted to say. Long-winded.
Thank you. Again, any questions? There's one.
How advanced is your support for things like left to right text, vertical text, embedded, different direction text, you know, that kind of stuff?
GIMP already does have text direction support. GIMP text is a mess in the user interface because GIMP is about to be 30 years old, and different features have been added over time, so we're rationalizing. But if you use the pop-up text editor, so in the tool options for text, the text tool, there's a little checkbox that says use editor. And if you enable that, there are text direction buttons. And there are 6 different combinations supported, I think, for left to right and right to left and vertical. And when it's vertical, do the glyphs rotate and which way around do they go? We would like to, there was in fact a GSOC proposal to improve it, but it came in too late. Came in a day after the Google deadline. But we would like to, I think it did anyway. But yes, we would really like to see improved support for vertical text for Chinese and Japanese and Korean and etc. I was involved in the Japanese layout requirement documents at W3C when I worked there. I have some idea of the complexities, and I worked on improving Chinese support in XSL at one point. And there were questions like when you've got English inside Arabic, inside Chinese, and it's set vertically, and it's underlined, on which side of that vertical line does the underline go? And it turns out that I think there's only 2 places where that's likely to come up in practice, and one is Malaysia, and I think the other one, although with different characters, is Mongolia. But... they're countries, there's lots of people, it matters. other places where you want emphasis, they use dots, so it's not an issue. and they say which side they go with respect to the characters. So there's a lot of work that we would like to do and get right that I know isn't right today. Hung punctuation is another common one. So, you know, if you have 2 Romaji characters in vertical Japanese, they're in parentheses. The parentheses go in the margin in the grid. We don't have that support. So we do have support for text direction, but there's a lot more that people want once they get that. Does that answer the question? Okay.
Thanks. Any other question? There's one over there.
If you just said that Pango is like going unsupported and Pango 2.0 is dying, are there any alternatives you are considering and why?
Yeah, I was being a little bit on the brief side to try and make this a lightning talk, not a thunder talk. Parts of Pango are going into GTK. For the rest, Matthias Klensen, who's the maintainer of Pango, says just use Halfbuzz. Now the problem with that, Halfbuzz is a shaping library that's kind of a layer below Pango. So the difficulty with that is it doesn't do fallback, for example, and it doesn't do line breaking. And if OpenType feature support is complex, line breaking, international mixed language line breaking is really exciting. And we don't all have Simon Cousins to, the group of people that you need to get this right is very specialist. So I don't know what will happen there. The answer is not tech, unfortunately, because the tech line breaking algorithm assumes a lot of author intervention. And in a user interface, the user is not the author. Right? So if you've got a dialog box with a label that isn't formatted correctly in your language on your screen,
The author isn't there to fix it. So you need something that's predictable, more predictable. And I think we will. I think that's going to be a major project, and I don't know where it's come from, and I don't know who's going to pay for it. Because right now, Pango does a mediocre job, but it does a job, and it's predictable, which is more important than doing a good job, it turns out. And does that answer it? Yeah, OK. I'm happy to talk more offline as well. But
thanks. So, thank you. Nobody offered to do the last lightning talk. You had your chance, so you will have to listen to me. In case that works. It doesn't work. That's too bad, because my laptop says it does work. But obviously, I'm not the guy saying anything here. So how about now? I do have two displays on my laptop, apparently. But there's nothing at your end. Yeah, could be. We read that yesterday, didn't we? I'm not sure if I've set that up. Anybody here who knows something about computers and stuff? Okay. I think let's skip it. To not let you wait any longer. Anyway, thanks for trying. I'm sorry. Thanks for trying. So there was a reason why no fifth person came up here. It wouldn't work. So do a coffee break until I can do it without slides. I mean, if anybody's interested and we still have some time, sure. Yeah? Okay. Let me. Goddamn. Technology. Just that I do know something I wanted to tell you. So yeah, it's about a community I'm living in, which is located roughly 100 kilometers southwest from here. So if you go by train to Stuttgart and then you hop off half of the journey, then you end up at my place, roughly. It was founded in 2010. There was a group thinking about building a community in Munich, meeting since 2007, had the idea of a nice place somewhere with a view on the Alps, at the lake, affordable, big. Yeah, obviously, it doesn't work. So they find this village that used to be an orphan's house for more than 100 years. It's called Schloss Tempelhof. Tempelhof is a little bit irritating because there's also a Tempelhof in Berlin. This is why I always say Schloss Tempelhof, which means castle, and there's an old castle building, not a very fancy Walt Disney one, but still a castle from the 16th century. And so we set that up there. If I say we, I was not included, I just came there later. Still, I'm always saying we. And so the idea was to have a project there that has some ecological values, that is social just, and offers a fulfilling life. So that were basically the core idea at that time. And one key part there was the protection of the environment and offering a life for families, and yeah, have some living off of different generations together. We then kind of founded three pillars, because in Germany you can't just start a community as a juristical person. There's no term community. So one was a foundation, and the specific aspect of a foundation is that it's very rigid, very stiff. They have a preamble, they have a values, and once it's attached to it, you cannot change it anymore. So this foundation was set in place, and they bought the ground. And so the ground is for eternity bound to the values of the foundation, and you cannot sell it anymore and build a hotel and do some money-making with it. The second one is a cooperative. And the cooperative is the organization that does all the managing. The key part of a cooperation is that it's very democratic. Everybody has one vote independently of how much money you have. So it's very democratic. By now, it has, I believe, 5 million turnover. And it's basically running all the operations. And then the third one, and that's a non-profit association, the Tempelhof e.V., eingetragener Verein, Verein, the German word for association, a not-for-profit, a non-profit association that offers getting donations that you can remove on your tax, stuff like that, and does all the cultural work, all the work that is for the common good. And I thought this is very interesting combination. It works very well for us. Obviously, it has some complexity in it, so I wouldn't recommend it for LGM to start like that. But yeah, the idea was there again that we create the structure that serves us and to think what do we need. And I think that is a valid approach to take. So what we have in this in our community, beside roughly 200 people living there, it's actually one seminar house, because we don't want to be like an island, but the stuff we are trying out is like a future workshop. We are trying out to how could future society work like. So we have seminars about that to share our experience. We have a community support agriculture. It's about 35 hectares of land, roughly. So we are self-sustained with vegetables by 90%, roughly. Obviously, there's some stuff that still doesn't grow in Germany, like even though we're all trying with climate change, but still it's too cold for like coffee or bananas or stuff like that. So we buy lots of stuff externally. So in general, we are self-sustained by roughly 50% or 60% of the food. We have a catering, we have a cafe. The cafe is an interesting one because it's a school project. So the school children are there and learning how to run a business. They do the bookkeeping on their own, they do the ordering on their own, do everything on their own. Sometimes you notice that if the queues get a little bit longer in front of the coffee machine, but it's a really interesting, cool concept, and they do know how to bake tasty cake. That's great. We have a farm store, we have a car sharing, which is something people normally know, and this is something I can then tell and use. Look, car sharing, you share your cars. How about other stuff you could share? I mean, we were just talking about sharing a Git repository with another organization, not set up our own, but look at your own households as well. Do you have a washing machine? Most of you probably have. How often do you use it? Like that 24 hours a day, how many hours of the day does it actually run? Probably not 24. So we have something like a washing community sharing washing machines. If anybody here is from Sweden, that sounds kind of normal to them because that's in their culture kind of usual, but in Germany it isn't. Why? Let's change that. We have a forest kindergarten, we have a free school, and we have some private business set up as well. So there are different things that are part of this community. And then we have still something that connects us, and this was something we here for LGM thought about, maybe talking about a vision statement, about some your values, and we also have some values. And one value is community, kind of makes sense. Diversity, which is something that enriches my life very much and still is challenging once in a while because, yeah, you have to get to consensus. The all-leader principle, which I think works really well here as well, that everybody is helping according to their possibilities, yeah? It's not that everybody needs to be able to do everything and not all need to be the leader at the same time, but in general, the idea is to look where can I help out, and that is not only one person. Relationship and communication is another value of us. And this is why I actually this morning did the warm-up with let's see who is connected to which project, let's see who is talking to whom, let's see who is from which area of the world, to get the communication going, to get the connections up again, the relationships between each other, because this is the part, I believe, that makes it work for us. If somebody asks us, how is this community working, I would always say it's about relationships to other people. Responsibility for your own living, for example, but obviously also for the environment, stuff like that. Economic transformation and sustainability. These are the values we're having. So now we're officially in coffee break, so I'm wondering how much more I should tell. Community building is like one part. Obviously, we're having a dedicated process for that, and paying attention to how that works. Let's skip that. Oh yeah, maybe something like how to vote, how to make form a decision is something interesting, because what we use and what I believe is very good is that, first of all, it's not like a majority decision, but it's consensus. Everybody has to agree, otherwise it won't happen. And then there's more than just saying yes and no, but there are like basically six steps. So from a yes, an agreement over slight concerns, an abstention, like a neutral one, severe concerns, which is still a yes, but with severe concerns, then standing aside. Standing aside is the first one that is a no. But a no, like, I will not block anything, but I will stand aside and please do, but don't expect me to help you. And then the last one is a veto, and the veto stops it. And if we do decisions, if we make decisions, we first of all present the proposal, and then we ask for a show of hands, like from this yes to a veto, and then we start discussing. So we start like, why do you have a veto? What is your reason for it? Why do you have standing aside? Why have you severe concerns? And so forth and so on. And also, why do you have a yes? And often this gets a discussion going to see, okay, in general, maybe the idea is very good, but let's not build, I don't know, the kindergarten next to the street, but let's build it over here where the kids are more safe. So we change the proposal and then we vote again. And I think this discussion and this different steps are very important to form a good decision. It takes time making decisions like that, but in my experience, the decision holds for a longer time. And in Germany, I think we have a reason to maybe improve on that. If I think of some airport or some train station where it was quickly decided to build it, and yeah, we're still building it, aren't we? So, then there's obviously lots of other stuff, like in the community, but also in private, things about sustainable living there, like sharing other things. We have like a free shop, stuff like that, exchanging stuff, not owning stuff. And then again, lots of other things that kind of form a quality of life that is very rich for me, at least, like yoga, choir, dancing, studios, workshops, sauna, events, concerts, stuff like that. And yeah, some stuff that I learned, and that will be my last slide, I'm not showing you. Some stuff I've learned, like from my life of living there for the last 8 years, is to be relaxed and more preserving. It takes time. That diversity is enriching, but also costs energy. That change takes time. That I do value relationships to like individual people, and that obviously it also takes time to foster these. To use the skills around you, so it's not always easy to wait for the perfect thing, but sometimes you just have to start going with what you have at hand, and often there's a big pool on resources around. To involve affected persons early, so if you want to change something and somebody's affected by it, go to them straight away, involve them in the process. Listen for reasons and ask why. By profession, I do user research, so that's something I often do, asking why to get an understanding. Yeah, start meetings with like a check-in to get everybody on board. We normally have a short period of quietness in the beginning of a meeting to let everybody arrive. That sets a different tone. Yeah, think about your values and be brave to act outside of the norm. That's the last one. Thank you. We don't really have time for questions, but I will take one.
So a show of hands is typically binary. You either raise or not. Does your community have six well-defined gestures to represent the six steps between a yes or no?
We do not. There are cultures who do it. Also, if you go to Socratic systems and stuff like that, there are cultures who have different signs. What we normally do, we just ask sequentially, like who has a yes, and then they show their hands, and six steps. That's how we do it, yeah.
How many people are you?
Roughly 200 people living together. The question was how many are there, yeah. And from that, I would say it's close to 100 who are like permanent members of the community, plus 50 children because of the school and the kindergarten, lots of families, and then another roughly 50 who are either employed or doing a vocational training, something like that, are just part-time there.
I believe that there could be biased results depending on which question you ask first. If you start asking for the yeses, or if you start asking from the noes, maybe the result would be biased based on the ordering of the questions.
Yeah. So there was a comment that maybe the results could be biased depending if you start asking for a yes and then leaving to the veto. That might be, that's how we do it. We start with a yes, but yeah, maybe we should try in a different way as well to see. Thank you, have a good coffee break. And we start after the coffee break, let me see. At 5:15.